two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind, until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey everyone, are you ready to add a sprinkle of joy to your day? Then you need to check out Add to Cart. Hi, I'm Sujan Pak.
And I'm Kulap Vilaysack. We're your hosts, and on this show, we talk about the things we buy, the things we buy into, and what it says about who we are.
That's right. Each week, we're going to have some honest and maybe, you know, a little TMI conversations about all the fabulous, weird, wonderful things we're adding to or ditching from our carts. You know, we talk about beauty products, latest health trends, philosophies we're passionate about. Nothing is off limits on this podcast.
We're diving deep into everything we and our guests buy into and exploring what it reveals about who we truly are. We're going to decide what's worth the investment, be it money or emotions.
Add to Cart from Lemonada Media has new episodes out on Tuesdays, wherever you get your podcasts.
Lemonada.
I think that a third shot is going to be part of the original vaccine regimen. Just the same way with hepatitis, where you have a prime, a boost after a month, and then 6 months later. So that the real proper regimen is a boost. We didn't have a chance to determine that early on because it was such an emergent situation. We had to get vaccines out to people. So all the tests were on a prime and a single boost. So we really need a boost.
Welcome to The Bubble. This is your host, Andy Slavitt. This is a special episode for a couple reasons. One is the guest, and the other is more personal. Dr. Fauci, Anthony Fauci, Tony Fauci, back in The Bubble. Dr. Lisa went out on the street and collected questions that you most wanted answers to. And it gives us about as good a read this conversation does as you're going to get on what we know and what decisions are likely to get made and like we're likely to need to make over the next several months. The latest data on the vaccines, how quickly we can vaccinate the globe, booster shots, how the president's making decisions, the differences between Pfizer and Moderna, many other things that you have on your mind. Tony and I worked together as part of a small team to vaccinate Americans beginning in January. As people know by now, he's served now 7 presidents. He's the chief advisor to President Biden on science. Our work together was an immense undertaking, and together he and I face the cameras twice a week. We'll talk a little bit about that, joke a little bit about that. And we basically had in front of us the job of trying to tell the public the truth about what's going on and our COVID response. Me sitting in the White House, Tony over at NIH. And he's my source of a lot of things, and I think it's a pleasure to be able to bring it to you freshly. I want to talk today about the idea of small adjustments and the power that these small adjustments can have, both in our lives and in the big picture. You know, if you've ever been in an uncomfortable position for too long, you often don't need a radical adjustment in order to fix things. A slight change will sometimes create a big improvement. There's lots of examples of this in our everyday life. Cracking the window a little bit to let in some air. A slight grin that will brighten your mood. A sigh and a deep breath can make you feel like the mountains are shifting in your directions. You don't need a complete life reset to feel better about your life. Often when you feel that way, it turns out it's the smaller things that can actually free you up. When you think about how a kind word or a smile has changed your disposition. Your teenager who just hated their new school one day, and the next came and told you it wasn't that bad. Why? Because a friend invited her over to their house or to sat with her to have lunch. Big adjustments are hard. Moving to a new city, ending a relationship, and they're sometimes scary. But think about the power of these small adjustments, and think about them when facing something even monumental, like the pandemic or even climate change. Things that are existentially scary and could stop us in our tracks from taking any action. We don't know what to do. We freeze. We maybe deny it for as long as we can. We just hope it isn't so. We don't know how to make a dent. And so we feel like if we can't go completely carbon neutral or we can't help end the pandemic, you know, what's the point? And we give up sometimes. The answer, I think, is to think about small adjustments. You know, I can put on a mask. I can install solar panels. If I want to see my aging parent, I can take an instant test. I can just make modifications. And, you know, between doing nothing and a radical change, there's often this small adjustment in the middle that's often best. We often don't even know that it's an option. But of course, when the small adjustment becomes a habit, you can consider making other ones, and other ones become easy because, you know, we know these are things we can do. They just don't seem so big. We've adjusted to a lot of radical things. I mean, face it, we used to be hunter-gatherers. We can adjust to things as they change on us, like the pandemic. And adjusting is essentially a way of saying that we're not powerless. You know, we're going to face some immutable things. It just is. I mean, viruses mutate. The climate is changing. Congress is a bunch of jerks. Politicians lie. You know, these things aren't going to change. But, you know, wear a mask. Reduce energy consumption. Exercise. Stop watching cable TV. Get off Twitter. Well, I can't even take that advice. These are the small actions that I believe if we take by the thousands, will drive change across the country. And it also just will show respect and shows people we care about them if we're willing to make small changes for us that benefit them. And I feel like the theme of some of our prior episodes around, you know, what is going on in Florida in this fight for Ground Zero is people just unwilling to make the smallest of changes in their life to make other people's lives better. And I think if we think about the fact that, you know, these changes aren't symbolic of us giving up on some American identity to wear a mask, to get vaccinated for others, to agree to comply with something that we don't want to, that these small changes are very much the things that our country's been made up of over time. And together, we've just got to make the world better for more people. Now, I also want to, before I get to Tony, send a special word out to someone that, frankly, I've been madly in love with for a long time. This person knows it. It hasn't been a secret. In fact, today, Lana has been my wife for 25 years. It's our anniversary. She's been my partner in experiencing fundamentally everything in these last 25 years. She's been the most go-to person in my life in good times and bad. And I'm incredibly proud that we've hit 25 years today. Now, of course, we're too young. We're both too young for that to be possible. But suspend your disbelief. I just want to remark and take the point to say that being joined at the hip with someone that you have such admiration for, who cheers you on and you cheer them on, that we, you know, beam at each other. We draw all of our inspiration and purpose from each other, and of course, our boys. And you know, you go through a lot in 25 years. If we don't think about that, it sounds like a long time when we think about 25 years ahead of us, but 25 years behind us. You know, the birth of two sons, the death of our fathers, some health scares, the early loss of three of our best friends. We moved cities, then we moved back. We've gone on trips by ourselves and with our kids. We've done evenings with our friends. We've had daytimes with our work that we each pursue. And I couldn't be a fraction of the person that I feel like I could be without her. So she's given me, just as she has other people, every bit of herself. I just get more of it than other people, and that's where I'm incredibly lucky. And I just love her like crazy. And I just have to say that now, here on the show. But I think she knows. Anyway, thank you for letting me do that. Couldn't get through the day without it. And now I'm going to bring it full circle back to Tony Fauci. And listen and enjoy this great conversation. Thanks.
Hi, Andy.
I recognize this man.
Hey, Andy. How are you?
I'm so good. How are you?
I'm good. We miss, I miss you.
I miss you too. I miss you a lot. You know, I don't miss the work so much, but I miss you guys.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're doing okay, but it'd be great to have you back. But I'm sure you're enjoying life and enjoying work.
I'm trying to do what I can to help from outside. I mean, I think that is the question most Americans have on their mind is, how are you managing without me?
It's very tough. You know, we talk about that every day. What are we doing here without Andy?
Oh, man. And how are you? I mean, you've been at this for, this has been a marathon for the country. We're sort of on the marathon, like watching the U.S. Open for 10. You've been on the court for like, you know, 18 months straight without a break. How are you holding up?
It's true. I'm okay. You know, it's almost surrealistic. I haven't had a day off really, Andy, literally in 18 months, not a single day off, not one single day off in 18 months. So
it's a good thing you're in your 40s.
Yeah. You know, if I was an old guy, it would be tough.
That'd be tough. How do you manage? I know you walk, I mean, you walk, but you manage to stay mentally very ahead of all the rest of us. How do you do that?
Well, I don't know about ahead of you guys, but at least I stay on, you know, on track. You know, I don't know what it is. It's
you're not allowed to have an off day. That's your problem. I mean, you literally can't have a bad game because so much is run, so much is on the line, so much pressure.
Yeah, 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 absolutely. But you know, something simple like trying to exercise every day, if you could. But my wife is an amazing partner in the sense that she's been through all of this throughout the, you know, the almost 40 years that we've been married, and she. You know, she's been through the worst of the AIDS epidemic with me and Ebola and Zika. And this is, it's good to have somebody who understands what you're going through.
Yeah. So she understands. I mean, you can tell the audience, she understands not just as a spouse, but she's also a person of science, as I understand, right?
Yes. Oh, yeah. She's the chair of the Department of Bioethics at the NIH. So she knows about all the sensitive issues and things. So she gets it, which is good.
It's incredible. Power couple.
Yeah.
yeah. And how's everybody else doing? I mean, you know, when I think about the president, and I think, you know, kind of the mood of the country when cases are dropping, everybody feels like, oh, we're doing it right. We're doing it well. Vaccinations are going up. And then, you know, sometimes cases are going up for reasons that have very little to do with anything you can control. Certainly there's better responses and worse responses. I'm not suggesting there's not. But how do you see his mood shifting when things get challenging?
You know, it's very interesting, Andy. I mean, I don't think people fully appreciate how many crises he's juggling at the same time. You know, you got a historic pandemic, you got Afghanistan, you have weather catastrophes like hurricanes that are historic in their nature, you know, all occurring at the same time. It's just amazing. He keeps his composure and he stays on track. It's truly amazing.
It always impressed me that he always seemed to know just the question to ask to make sure that the average person who is not able to get a lot of information and who is subject to maybe disinformation, but just maybe even isn't even paying that much attention to kind of current events, to ask about how to make sure we're taking care of them and focusing on them. I always found that incredibly grounding.
Yeah, yeah. Very insightful and empathetic person.
Well, and it's great that he has you as an advisor. So we had one of my colleagues walk the streets with a microphone and said, if you had to have a question for Dr. Fauci, what would it be? And so we got some really great questions, and I hope you don't mind. There's only about 5,000 of them, so we're going to try to do our best to get to. No, I've boiled them down to a few, just a handful, and they're all the kinds of things that are on people's minds that. If you don't mind, we'll just
sure
run them. Yeah. We'll play them.
Let's go at it.
Okay, so I think a big question on a lot of people's minds seems to be boosters and whether or not boosters are effective and whether they need to get a booster, when to get a booster, and so forth. But can you maybe start with what you saw or the data you saw that started to lead you to believe that it probably would be appropriate at this point in time to recommend booster shots?
Yeah, you know what it was, Andy? We were examining the CDC data. And when you looked at the durability of efficacy against infection, as well as efficacy against severe disease, they were clearly showing a mild to modest diminution of protection over time against plain infection, mildly symptomatic, moderately symptomatic, and only the very early inklings of a diminution of protection against severe disease. Pretty clear, but minimal. So they were saying, appropriately, that it looks like protection against severe disease is really holding up. The only difficulty is that we are about a month and a half behind Israel in everything, in the sense of the temporal rollout of the outbreak, the number of cases, the vaccinations. So we were able to make connections with our Israeli colleagues, and they shared data with us that was not yet published, which is now published. And that is that they were seeing a substantial diminution in protection against infection, but clearly a significant diminution against protection against severe disease. So they already started on their booster program. So that made us plan, as we came out with, that pending approval by the FDA and the ACIP with the CDC, that we were planning on rolling out our booster plan around the week of the 20th of September. Having said that, what I think the reality is going to be, Andy, I believe that it isn't a question of a vaccine regimen that failed, that you needed a booster. I think that a third shot is going to be part of the original vaccine regimen. Just the same way with hepatitis, where you have a prime, a boost after a month, and then 6 months later. So that the real proper regimen is a boost. We didn't have a chance to determine that early on because it was such an emergent situation. We had to get vaccines out to people. So all the tests were on a prime and a single boost. So we really need a boost because if you look at the Israeli data now being ahead of us, they already have data on what the effect of the boost is. And it's really impressive. In other words, when you boost someone starting from around 12 days onward, you reconstitute the protection against infection and you reconstitute the protection against severe disease. And you do that by about tenfold. So the data are very, very clear that A, you need a booster, and B, the boosters really work.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. After season one aired, I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. And of course, my 90-year-old mom, Judy. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me Season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
People love to pretend that there are simple formulas for living your best life now. Eat this and you won't get sick. Manifest it and everything will work out. But there are some things you can choose and some things you can't. And it's okay that life isn't always getting better. I'm Kate Bowler, and on Everything Happens, I speak with kind, smart, funny people about life as it really is. Beautiful, terrible, and everything in between. Let's be human together. Everything Happens is available wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, we're going to test how good a student I've been of yours by whether the questions I ask you make any sense whatsoever. But so let me start with the pre-boost. As you see diminution, as you say, and hospitalizations, we know that at least at the outset, we're talking 98, 99% protection against hospitalization. How much did Israel show hospitalization? How big a decline did they see?
Yeah, that went down to around 70-ish in the mid-70s. It went from 98, 97 down to 77, 78.
Okay. And is there any reason to think that that's specific to Pfizer and that Moderna might be different? Or is there a reason to think that they're probably close to the same? I know there was this one study at Mayo seemed to indicate that it was not peer-reviewed, I know, but it seemed to indicate that there might be some differences between the two.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a slight difference, probably that the ultimate effect is going to be the same. It might be a little bit later. Moderna, as you know, is three times the dose of Pfizer. So there are clearly studies that show that the level of antibody that's induced with Moderna is about 2.5 times the higher than the amount by Pfizer, even though they're both high enough to give extraordinarily good protection. So what I would imagine, though I don't know this as a fact, I would imagine you're going to see the same situation with Moderna as you're seeing with Pfizer, only it's going to be a little bit later. It's going to lag a little bit.
Got it. And so, as I understand it, mostly from listening to you, there are three types of responses that the vaccine creates in our bodies. There's, of course, the antibody increase, which we've just been talking about. There's also the memory B cells and of course, the T cells. And so when we talk about what we see going on with the vaccine beginning to wane over time, I want to see if I can pick apart and understand both those three components, as well as this confounding factor of during the period of time when things started to wane, Delta emerged. And so, and I know that the CDC was trying to take a look at how to pull some of these things apart, but are you able to tell how much of that is due to Delta, how much of it is due to waning, and then what the effects are on those three different, on those cellular forms of immunization?
Okay, so let's unpack that one at a time. There's no doubt in my mind, Andy, that it is both waning and Delta. It isn't just waning, because before Delta came, you saw the diminution was already going down. So clearly it's waning. When Delta came, given its increased ability to transmit, you saw an even more profound drop because you saw a lot more transmissibility. So that's the answer to your first question. The answer to your second question, it's complicated, but it's sort of elegant immunology in the following way. The thing you usually measure is antibody levels, which are going to be the things that immediately will be there to stop the infection, for example, in the upper airway. They also get involved in the lungs, but the lungs also have innate immunity. They have T cell involvement. And they will require the generation of a memory B cell from the memory B cell response. Because the memory B cells, when you trigger them, they're ultimately going to make antibodies. So what you're seeing is that the memory B cells require getting stimulated and getting an anamnestic response. So it is very likely that what you will see is you will see a diminution of protection when the level of antibody is very low, because protection against infection is an immediate phenomenon. It gets into the nose, it starts to replicate. It takes a while before it gets into the lung. And by that time, we believe, though we haven't proven it, but we believe you've given the B cells enough time to generate a memory response. That's the reason why protection against severe disease is in many respects easier to maintain than protection against infection.
I guess that's why it surprises me to hear you say that in Israel, we saw hospitalizations go from the 90s to the 70s. Does that imply some sort of failure in the response of the memory B cells or the T cells?
No, I think it in some respects, yes, because you never got them stimulated enough to quantitatively have enough. And that's the reason why I believe, Andy, that the correct regimen is going to be three doses. It isn't as if two doses failed, let's try for three. It's like three is the right combination.
Three, or is it possible two, 6 months apart?
That's, no, good point.
Eh?
Student.
Yeah.
We're gonna give you a degree in immunology. No, absolutely. Because we know that if you give the immune system time to mature and get a higher affinity, that if you give the second dose a little bit later, and as a matter of fact, it's really interesting, Andy, that the Brits did that because they didn't have enough doses. So they were trying to stretch out. So they, because of a shortage of doses, gave up to 12 weeks or more between the first dose and the second dose. And they've done much better in two doses than those who did the two doses close together.
Got it.
So they probably almost inadvertently did the right experiment, namely giving it time to mature.
Right. Got it. And so do we believe, is one of the implications of what you're suggesting that with this third dose in the regimen, that if the antibody counts stay boosted, stay higher, that will not only reduce symptomatic disease, but will bring us to a place where vaccinated people are much less likely to be infectious?
Yes. And let me tell you why. Not only do I conceptually think that's true, but if you go into the Israeli data, simultaneously with their dramatically increasing the protection against infection and serious disease, the R-aught in their cohort diminished from 1.33 to 1.11, which means they clearly were preventing transmission.
This is with the boost.
This is only with the boost. Interesting. Absolutely.
So there's something in the 10 to 15% improvement, which, since it's only given to part of the population, that sounds quite significant. I mean, I can't quite do the math in my head, but it sounds quite significant.
Yeah.
So based on what we've seen in Israel and based on what we've seen in, I guess we're down the road in Germany as well, we are seeing that the boost is having the kind of effect that we're hoping it would.
Yes. Indeed. And I was very impressed. And the Israelis are coming out now in preprint servers with their work. And I think when the rest of the world sees it all, they'll be very impressed.
Well, good. I mean, this feels like an optimistic assessment. I don't mean you're being optimistic. I mean, relative to what we could be hoping for in the booster, you know, if things play out the way you described them, then, you know, we're going to both improve our chances at reducing the spread as well as keeping people alive, which are obviously two twin goals here. Is there a pessimistic case? I mean, is there a scenario you worry about where things don't work quite as you hope?
Yeah. I mean, my pessimistic case, Andy, is that if we don't get the virus under control globally, which is going to be much, much more of a challenge, I think, than getting it under control in the United States or the UK, that we'll continue to have such a level of virus replication and dynamics in the global community that we're going to ultimately select for a variant that's not going to be well controlled, even with a high level of antibodies. The good news about Delta is that even though the boost is against the original prototype virus, it's not against Delta, that when you increase the levels of antibodies so high, it crosses over and protects against all variants. Because we've seen, for example, that in Israel, the Delta variant is overwhelmingly dominant. But when you give the third boost, even though you're boosting against the prototype, the protection of the vaccine reconstitutes and goes above what it was with two doses.
Got it. Well, let's talk about the globe then for a second, because, you know, I agree with you that it is co-equal, the top challenge and priority that we have, along with keeping people in our country safe and vaccinating the pockets in the U.S. where we haven't vaccinated yet. My understanding is we've done about 5 billion shots globally, which is actually, you know, feels like quite a bit of good progress. I mean, we're doing about 1 billion shots a month around the globe. Still, I think as we get through it, we will have done a nice job in Europe, North America, East Asia, but have a lot of work to do in South Asia and Africa. And by the math that I've done, and you can correct me if you've seen differently, we should have enough vaccines to vaccinate the globe sometime in the first part of 2022. And why I'm a little less specific is because I don't know if we're talking two shots, three shots, one shot, adults only, et cetera. But you know, very strict math is that you can get one shot into 70% of the globe. We'll have enough vaccines to do that kind of by February or March. The challenge, of course, seems to be the same challenge we had in the U.S., only more large, at large, which is it takes a lot of logistics. It takes a lot of cold transport. It takes a lot of conversations with clinicians. It takes a lot of infrastructure. And those things are easier in some countries than others. Do you think it's a realistic goal to say that we can vaccinate the globe in the first quarter to the first half of next year?
No, I don't think that's going to happen. I think from a pure, just like you said, from all the logistic constraints and even from the production, I think we're talking more like end of 2022, beginning of 2023.
To get to what portion of the globe?
You know, what did you say, 70%?
70%, yeah.
I think it's probably going to be well into 2022. The middle to end of 2022 into the beginning of 2023.
That seems really concerning, right? It seems like the opportunity, if that's the fact, and I don't dispute that that's the way things may be without any changes headed to playing out, but it seems to me that that gives the virus an awful lot of opportunities to mutate, that if we were able to do it in the beginning of 2022, we'd be in a lot better off. Does that concern you too?
Yeah, it does. It does. I mean, that's the reason why we've got to do as best as we possibly can, but I don't think it's going to be the beginning of 2022. Remember, Andy, 2020, it's, you know, September, October, November, December, it's like 5 months away, the beginning of 2022. That's the problem, yeah.
I don't say January, but I'd say the end of first or second quarter, because if we've done 5 billion vaccines and there's 8 billion people on the globe, you got 16 billion, 70% of them is, you know, you're talking 12. Again, now this is a two-dose regimen. You know, so that's another 6.5-7 billion doses, and we're producing 1 billion a month. And so we're in, you know, September, October, November, December, January, February. We're talking about to get one vaccine in 70% of the globe based on manufacturing capacity. It feels like you could do that by February.
Right. And the question is, are you going to get it into people's arms? That's the issue.
Can't get enough of your favorite Lemonada Media podcasts? By subscribing to Lemonada Premium today, you'll gain access to fun and inspiring bonus content from all of our podcasts across the Lemonada Media Network.
As a subscriber, you can listen to never-before-heard interview excerpts between Julia Louis-Dreyfus and her A-plus guests on Wiser Than Me, laugh along with Elise Myers as she and her guests play a rapid-fire questions game on Funny 'Cause It's True, and continue to uncover new ways to make life suck less through our exclusive subscriber audio. Check out a free trial of Lemonada Premium today in the Apple Podcast app by clicking on our podcast logo and then the subscribe button.
Welcome to The Dough, where cash is queen and we hardly know her, but we're still here figuring her out together because, y'all, season two is here. Hosted every week by me, ex-Maya. Remember me? I'm going to be talking to all types of people about their relationship to money. I'm talking to reality stars, entrepreneurs, financial experts, and even some of my own friends. Basically, anyone who will get real with me about their dollars, how they make money, how they spend it, and how they save it, because I'm trying to retire early, people. Season two of The Dough is out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
I know you're our representative at the WHO. What appear to be the issues? Because it feels like if you could somehow compress, if those numbers are roughly right, if you could somehow if it takes another 8 to 9 months after February to get vaccines in people's arms, and you could do that more quickly,
right?
And again, we're talking mostly about Africa, South Asia, certainly pockets of South America, Central America. Feels like if that's the most important thing with kind of full G7, G20 leadership, it feels like that would be a priority to try to accelerate it.
I agree with you completely. And that's the reason why I would hope that we use the infrastructure that's already in place that actually is not being fully utilized. I mean, I've spoken to my colleagues who are involved in the PEPFAR program. Mm-hmm. You know, with PEPFAR, with HIV/AIDS, we set up this extraordinary infrastructure to be able to distribute drugs for HIV, we could utilize that in a vaccine campaign. That's what I'd like to see.
Yeah, no, I've been talking to the PEPFAR folks, hearing the very same thing you are. Let me ask you a tough question, but it feels to me like if the U.S. could say to the globe, we can commit to participating and leading the way to vaccinating the globe at the levels we're talking about roughly in the first part of next year, that it's not so controversial for us for not just the U.S., but for the first world nations, the 10 largest, wealthiest nations, to take their third shot.
Right.
It feels to me like if we say, no, it's not going to happen until the latter half of 2022 or 2023, and maybe I'm picking arbitrary times here, that it is a little more challenging to say to other countries, let us take our third shot before we put a first shot in the arms of other people in the globe. I'd hope we could be able to do both.
Right.
I would like to think that we could say, if there's ever a time for us to call it the big guns and do both, using the PEPFAR assets, exactly as you say, would be a great time to do that.
I totally agree, Andy, totally.
So let's talk about variants. I think that's really helpful to people on boosters. It tells me that, you know, we need to get boosted and that there's an optimistic scenario under which getting boosted will be part of this first regimen and not, as you say, like a flu booster a year later. And of course, what we have to be watching for are what comes after Delta. Let me give you again my layperson's understanding. And again, we'll see how well you've taught me. That in evolutionary biology, the virus basically struggles to survive. And there's kind of two basic ways it can do that. It can struggle to survive by overcoming the vaccine and therefore surviving that way, or spreading far and wide so it can't be caught, i.e. being more contagious.
Right.
Delta as a variant is the latter. The vaccines can defeat it by and large, but it's awful hard to catch. It's a fast runner. It runs fast. It runs quick. Beta and other things we've seen have been a little tougher on the vaccine, but thankfully have been outcompeted by things that are running faster like Delta.
Right.
So it seems like if that's the right formulation, that the big fear is you get a future variant that is both more contagious and also more evasive. Is that what we worried about?
You hit the nail right on the head. That's exactly what you worry about. You worry about high transmissibility and a refractoriness to vaccine and high pathogenesis. You know, 351, the South African one way back that we were worried about,
yeah,
that's a more worrisome virus from a pathogenesis standpoint in some respects than Delta. But Delta knocked it right off the chart.
Right.
So, you know, in some respects, it's bad news that we got Delta. But in some respects, it's good news that Delta isn't particularly more, you know, evasive, as it were, from the vaccine than the others. Right.
Right. So when we look at you know, Lambda, Mu, and some of these other things we're seeing in South America, do any of those have the properties that concern you that they are combination of beta and delta, that they have both of those elements together?
You know, I don't think we could say that, Andy. They have the constellation of mutations that say they could likely spread more readily because they have just the right receptor binding domain mutations, but they don't have the capability, as you said. They're not sprinters. They're not the fast runners. At least in the presence of Delta, they haven't knocked Delta off. I mean, Mu, everybody's talking about Mu because it has a few extra more mutations. And in vitro, it's worrisome. But we have Mu here, and it's getting suppressed by Delta. Delta's 99%+ in the United States.
So we don't see a path where Mu is going to be able to overtake Delta, at least right now.
No, at least right now, I don't see that. But again, you know, you don't ever put anything past viruses.
Sure.
Right.
And is there a reason why we haven't seen a virus that has both characteristics, or is it just randomness that we haven't and we're very likely to?
It's random. It really is random.
That's random.
I think we're fortunate that we haven't seen both. Yeah. See, so let me give you an example of random. You know, people over the decades, and they used to ask me all the time, what is your worst nightmare? What keeps you up at night? And if you go back on the record of my recorded remarks, it's always, you know, you have a virus like the 2009 swine flu, which was extremely efficient in transmission, but was a wimpy virus when it came to pathogenesis. Mm. The deaths that year were very, very low. Then you had the H5N1, H7N9, the one that jumped from chickens to humans. It was ferocious in its morbidity and mortality, like 30%, 35% mortality, but it was horrible in its efficiency from going to human-human. So my worst nightmare, I used to say, was a virus that has both, that has extraordinary capability of transmitting from human to human, and that has the capability of a high degree of morbidity and mortality, particularly in selected populations. And that's exactly what happened with COVID. Hmm. And that's why COVID, historically, is the worst respiratory-borne pandemic that we've had in 102 years. And it gets right back to what you just asked. It's just random that you happen to have a virus that has a combination of characteristics that makes it very formidable.
One of the things that you may not recall this, but you were on the show last year not that long before I came and joined you in the administration. And one of the things you taught all of us was that you tend to be able to be more optimistic about vaccines if the body itself can produce a response in response to a virus. And that one of the reasons why you weren't surprised that we were having such success and why you were so hopeful that we would ultimately have vaccines that would be effective is because the body could recognize the virus, the body could respond to the virus. It made it an easier target for the vaccine. I know I'm paraphrasing, so you please correct if I didn't get that right.
No, you're relating it correctly.
Okay, good. So what does that, let's play this out, and let's say we have a Greek alphabet letter from something that emerges in some country that has those two random properties that we don't like. In other words, it mutates in a way that the current vaccine, even boosted, can't handle well. And it is highly more contagious than Delta. So more contagious than Delta means it's approaching kind of measles-like contagiousness, just kind of crazy. From a science perspective, where does that leave us And how quickly do you think we'll be able to respond and create a vaccine that can defeat it?
You know, as strange as it may sound, it doesn't bother me. It does bother me because I don't like to see suffering and death. But from a scientific standpoint, the fact that something is really contagious and really pathogenesis is less relevant regarding a vaccine than whether or not the body makes a good immune response. So you take HIV. HIV, the body does not naturally make a good immune response against HIV. So here we are 40 years into the outbreak, and we don't have a good vaccine. But if you told me, Tony, we have a COVID strain that's highly transmissible and very, very pathogenic, I would say, well, that's bad news. But get a group of people infected by it, and if a certain proportion of them ultimately clear the virus, they may get sick, but their immune system ultimately clears the virus, I would tell you, Andy, that tells me we can make a vaccine against this, no matter how transmissible it is and no matter how pathogenic it is, because you got to go with the body's ability to do something naturally. That's what would dictate whether or not we're going to be successful or not.
And so we had Albert Bourla on the show, and he said that he thinks that they can be roughly, I can't remember if he said 90 days or 100 day cycles in order to create a new vaccine to respond to a new variant because of the work that's already done. That's what his team tells him. Now, that doesn't account for manufacturing time and distribution and so forth, but does it sound right to you that if we saw something, let's say, in March of next year, that by June, July, we'd be in a place where we had something that could get through FDA? And in fact, obviously, this is a theoretical question, not a question about what the agency is doing. But does that sound like the right time frame, or do you think it's longer than that?
No, I agree with Albert. I think given the technology and the flexibility of the mRNA technology, which is one of the reasons why it's such a favorable technology. But as you said, that doesn't take into account manufacturing capability, but we can get one ready to go. So I think that if we stick by that, in fact, Andy, you know, because before you left, we were talking about pandemic preparedness plans, broad plans. Remember what we were saying? You remember one of the goals were to be able to get a vaccine within 100 days and get it distributed within the next 100 days, you know, with manufacturing. So if we build up the capability with these new platforms like mRNA, I think what Albert says is entirely feasible.
So we could have a bad couple of months. I mean, we could have a few months, 3 months, 5 months, 6 months, where it feels like we're in real danger, but not the kind of danger that we can't recover from. And again, we haven't talked about it on this show, but you and I just now, but obviously all of this puts lots of pressure on NPIs and public awareness and public consistency. And that's something we've had a much tougher time of than the science, right? Unfortunately. But if we're going to think about preparing for a scenario that might be difficult, thinking about a 5 or 6 month period where we're reconstituting the fight against a variant might be one of those.
Right. Well, and a really good example of another element that's important, Andy, is the idea of surveillance. So let's say a virus emerges in China again, okay? And we know, like, on day one that it is really transmitting very, very well and it's killing people. If we set the clock at day one and it takes 100 days to get something that you could get into clinical trials, and then maybe just another additional time, you're talking about, remember when COVID-19 came, it didn't really hit us badly in the country until, you know, the end of the first quarter of 2020. So if we add that amount of time, you realize that even though it's hurting people in other countries because it's exploding, by the time it gets around the world, you got a pretty good head start if you got the technology to get you there.
Got it. So we're just going to need to be nimble. And I think you're exactly right. That's a lot of the preparation work you and others and David have been doing. I'm going to close on two quick questions. And I so appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. The first is about an oral antiviral, because in any scenario, it feels like something that is Tamiflu-like, something that is easily accessible, doesn't need to be injected or infused, but that if someone gets COVID, they can take and it essentially will keep them out of the hospital and keep a severe disease from rolling, would be yet another great tool in our arsenal. I know there's trials going on right now. Can you give us a sense of, is that right? And B, is that something that do you think we can conceive of having in the near future?
The answer is yes, it is a correct concept. And I'm thinking of an orally administered, hopefully one pill a day, that you give anywhere from 7 to 10 days upon the acquisition of knowledge that you're infected with SARS-CoV-2 to prevent the virus from going from the upper airway into the lung. And if it gets into the lung, to suppress it in the lung. We have at least 3 and maybe 5 candidates that were already involved in clinical testing, polymerase inhibitors, protease inhibitors. I believe that is going to be the answer, complementing vaccines, of getting us out of this. Because there will be people who get infected, either because they get breakthrough infections being vaccinated, or they don't make a good response to begin with, who you're going to want to treat. So I consider that a pillar of the response together with vaccines. And I think it's doable. We did it with HIV, Andy.
You did.
You know, we went from nothing to antivirals that totally transformed the lives of HIV, of persons with HIV.
And when do you think, roughly, I mean, I know we're in the middle of trials and we've got candidates. Does the outlook look like before the end of the year, early next year, or really too early to say, and probably later than that?
I think we could get at least one of the candidates that are being tested right now, knowing whether they work by the end of the year. And I think as we get into the first quarter, second quarter of 2022, we'll likely have more than one candidate.
That's great. The last question I want to ask you is about long COVID and about the research. You know, there's funding, you know, within the NIH. I don't know if any of that grant funding has gone out to this point, but it feels like, for all the attention that we give vaccines, that in addition to an antiviral, treatments and understanding what's going on with long COVID is another priority. I know it's a priority of yours. So I'm wondering if you can update us on how that looks.
Well, we've been given $1.15 billion to look at that. And we have already, because you asked a good question, has money gone out yet? We have already now developed cohorts, and the money has gone out the door to develop the first cohorts to be able to study it for its incidence, you know, its prevalence, its pathogenesis, and is there any interventions that we could do? Because it's a real phenomenon. It's not maybe. There are a considerable number of people ranging from, you know, 10 to up to 30%. Who have variable periods of time measured sometimes in weeks and sometimes in many months of symptoms and signs that could be incapacitating: profound fatigue, muscle ache, temperature dysregulation, sleep disturbances, concentration difficulties. Yeah, it's real and we're taking it very seriously.
Got it. So you have to answer this honestly. Were these the best questions you've ever been asked? I know you've done a lot of interviews, but
yeah, unbelievable. I mean, you've knocked it out of the park. It's going to embarrass all the others who've interviewed me. I can tell you.
Apologies to Wolf and everyone that had to do this, but you've given us an extraordinary amount of time. You're incredibly generous, and what I think people don't. Everyone knows you for your grace and your knowledge. But what I tell people is just what a wonderful human being you are personally. And it, on top of all of that stuff, so I'm grateful for clearly some of the things you've taught the country and how you stick in there. And I don't know how you do it, but I'm really grateful to you.
All right, thanks a lot, Andy. It's great to see you again, and I appreciate being on with you. It was really a pleasure. Take care.
Let's go do some dating apps now, okay?
Take care. Thanks a lot, Andy.
See you, Tim.
All right, bye-bye.
Thanks to Tony. Doesn't his personality just shine through when you listen to him talk? I think he just brings so much of the spirit of kind of what we admire in people. Courage, grace, humility, knowledge, intellect. And I can tell you, just an absolute, as I said, great human being, pleasure to work with. Funny guy too. Let me tell you what's coming up on the next two shows, because they're going to be just as good. Lori Garrett, the Pulitzer Prize-winning science journalist. Boy, she is amazing. She's a firecracker. It is a fun, and intense conversation, to be followed by the other person that won a Pulitzer Prize for journalism around the pandemic, Ed Yong. So two of the best writers, describers, thinkers, communicators about the pandemic, following up on this episode with Fauci. I'm incredibly fortunate to have them here. I'm incredibly fortunate to have you all listening in. I'm incredibly fortunate to have made my 25th anniversary today with Lana. Okay, we'll talk to you in the coming week. Thanks for listening to In the Bubble. Hope you rate us highly on your podcast apps. We're a production of Lemonada Media. Chrissy Pease and Alex McCohen produced the show. Our mix is by Ivan Kuriev. Jessica Cordova-Kramer and Stephanie Whittleswax are the executive producers of this show. We love them dearly. Our theme was composed by Dan Malad and Oliver Hill, with additional music by Ivan Kuriev. You can find out more about our show on social media at Lemonada Media. And you can find me at @AceLavitt on Twitter or at @AndySlavitt on Instagram. If you do like what you heard today, please tell your friends. And please stay safe, share some joy. We will definitely get through this together.
Do you ever get hit with a cringy memory of your 13-year-old self out of nowhere, and suddenly you're panic sweating and laughing at the same time? Don't worry. We all get that. It's because being an adolescent is one of the most visceral shared experiences we have as people, and we want to talk about it. Join me, Penn Badgley, and my two friends, Nava and Sophie, on Podcrushed as we interview celebrity guests about the joys and horrors of being a teenager and how those moments made them who they are today. New episodes of Podcrushed are out on April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Last Day from Lemonada Media explores the moments that change us. Those times where you look back and say, whoa, one day I was myself and the next I wasn't. I'm Stephanie Whittleswax, and I have seen time and time again how sharing these stories can change lives. So, do you have a moment in your life that changed you fundamentally and forever? What happened? How did you move through it? And how did you eventually start again? If you'd like to share your story, go to bit.ly/lastdaystories, bit.ly/lastdaystories. We can't wait to hear from you.